Okay, well, let's switch to Michael's impossible question, which is, and I say it's impossible because obviously we know the ways in which the history national curriculum has been constituted in England, and then the fragmentation of the English secondary school system in relation to making it very, very complicated to get some sense of, how the teaching of empire history, if you like, has changed over the last 50 years. But Michael, have you got any sense, based on your experiences, of how that teaching has changed in the last 50 years? And then, if you can, comment on whether that reflects any of some of the historiographical trends that Priya was just kind of outlining there.
Well, sure, I'll have a go. It is impossible, but I'll have a go, Jason. I mean, I think it's really interesting listening to Priya talk about that, the changing research, the nature of the historiography and so on. And there are some fantastic examples, really recently, I'm thinking of the way in which this impacts on the school curriculum, sometimes through individual scholars, Priya's own work, with teachers and students, and other scholars like, I mean, I think someone like Toby Green at King's has been doing amazing work, really, in terms of just building teachers and students' substantive knowledge of West African kingdoms and about engaging them with the different evidence base that has to be used, is some of that wider cultural history that Priya's spoken about is going to be considered. So that's kind of, as well as the curriculum and the influence of, if you like, the curriculum structures on what is taught and students' engagement with the British Empire, there's that relationship between academic history and what's going on in classrooms that can actually, in some ways, bypass the formal curriculum structures, if you like. So I see three influences, really. The academic history is one. I think there's a general problem in that often what is taught in classrooms lags behind some of the most really recent and interesting research in the academy. And I think we're addressing that. I mean, I think organizations like the Historical Association, the Schools History Project, and the willingness of academics to engage is really helping us overcome this problem. But in the past, that has been quite a perennial problem. So that relationship between academic history and its impact on school history is one factor. And there are some, as I said, there are some kind of positive signs in that respect. The other one that you just spoke about, Jason, is the curriculum context. And that's really complex and problematic, obviously. And I don't have time to kind of go into the kind of long history of this. But I think the point I'd make is that those who have recently, actually over the last 2 years, argued that we need to have the teaching of the British Empire enforced, I think are leading us in the wrong direction, really. This is an irrelevance. No, from the very outset in 1990 with the first national curriculum more than 30 years ago, the British Empire was there. You remember that there were core British units, and expansion, trade, and industry, 1750 to 1900, was one of the core British units. Often, from the very beginning, then, a national curriculum, aspects of empire would be taught. One of the optional units was the British Empire at its zenith. 1877 to 1905, it was optional. It wasn't much taught. People did things like castles and cathedrals, if you remember, instead. So there was always that kind of optionality that was sometimes problematic. But it was there in the national curriculum and has continued to be. I think the most recent iteration of the national curriculum, the 2014 national curriculum, devised by Gove and then modified in the light of outcry from educationalists and historians. I think this iteration is the weakest iteration of the national curriculum we've ever had. It requires, though, the teaching of the British Empire in its earliest phases and gives some examples of the way in which that can be focused on. We have the first colony in America and first contact with India as a suggestion of what might be taught in the earliest phase. And then in the kind of middle phase in the late 18th, 19th century, we've got Britain's transatlantic slave trade, its effects and eventual abolition, the development of it, the British Empire within a depth study, for example, of India. And then in the 20th century, the suggested content is Indian independence and the end of empire. So my point is that in the present national curriculum, there are plenty of opportunities to study the British Empire. But at one level, this matters not a jot because academies do not have to follow the national curriculum. And we've never had a national curriculum in this country because the independent schools have never had to follow it. No. Yeah. So I don't think we should get too hung up on the curriculum context, because in a way, I think that's the least important influence, really. Mm-hmm. Although I would say, I think it's problematic at GCSE and A-level, perhaps more so at GCSE. The GCSE history is problematic, and it's partly problematic because in terms of the way in which the Department for Education has defined the criteria for constructing specifications, that they often kind of make a requirement that a certain percentage of British history has to be taught and a certain amount of wider world history has to be taught. And the British Empire as a focus of study simply falls between those two. British history is interpreted as domestic in a kind of narrow sense. And so I think because of that, that the kind of problematic structure post 14, the British Empire is not well taught and not very much taught post 14. So if you like, that's the curriculum context. The third context, I think, apart from academic and curriculum context, are the wider cultural influences. And actually, I think these are much more important, really, in terms of determining what goes on in the classroom. I mean, I see these wider curricular influences or wider cultural influences as being kind of hurricanes and gentle breezes, you know? And for me, there was a mild hurricane, if you like, in the early 20th century, you know, the backlash against Ferguson, really, and his interpretation. Most recently, we've had a massive hurricane in terms of the events of the last 2 years. Really. And, you know, Priya expressed that perfectly earlier on. It offers lots of potential, I think, but is also deeply problematic because of the backlash from the far right and from actually some mainstream politicians. One of the things that gives me huge hope is that as part of the wider cultural influence, our students are demanding that they learn about it. And we have some amazing teachers doing some wonderful things in relation to it. You only need to read the latest edition of Teaching History on race and read those articles by Kerry Apps and by Hannah Cusworth and Dan Linden Cohen and be blown away by the wonderful things that are going on in schools. And often, in many cases, that's in response to what the students themselves are saying about the kinds of histories they want to study.
I mean, the only piece that I'm aware of is Terry Hayden, who did a piece of work in 2016. Terry's based at UEA. And some of the things he definitely would echo what Michael's talking about, which is that it's talk of the empire's absence in schools is definitely overstated. However, three sort of key themes he identified in 2016 is that the teaching of it often stops short of decolonization, that limited attention is given to the role of empires more generally, that actually that other empires are available. And then the other limitation is that actually, and I think this is perhaps what Michael's talking about when there is a sense of a shift even between when Terry was writing in 2016 and now. The final limitation he identified with the current approaches is the way in which they failed to trace the presence of empire into the present. And I think actually that's not as true. I think there's lots of examples emerging now of teachers really partly, as Michael says, responding to their students' interests to try and think about those traces of the presence of the empire into the present, of using academic scholarship like the UCL legacies of the Transatlantic Slave Trade Project and thinking about ways in which they can bring that into the classroom. Antoinette Burton, who's one of the sort of progenitors of the New Imperial Project, is also, who needs nation? You know, is this really the most useful unit of analysis, not just for studying empire, but also for studying more generally? And I would make a plea for locality, you know, that actually in the nation state, we can go outwards to think global, but we can also really think, particularly if we think about the classroom, about the ways in which localities might be really profoundly useful in those contexts as well.
I totally agree with that. And there's some powerful examples, really, of the relationship between locality and community and the way in which a focus on that can reinforce students' sense of personal identity and their multiple identities. I mean, really, really interesting, I think, quite moving, actually, that Hannah Cusworth's article in the latest edition of Teaching History, she mentions that she was educated in Brighton. And as a mixed race 12-year-old, she felt kind of a disconnect between her and the history curriculum. But actually discovering that Sarah Forbes Bonetta had lived just a few streets away from where she was being educated in Brighton, Hannah discovered this at the age of 30, and she writes that it made her cry. Mm-hmm. You know, when she, you know, if only, she says, I'd known that when I was 12 years old.